Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Janipa, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Understanding the Importance of Clinical Trials, What You Need to Know. And this is such an important topic in really the advancement of cancer treatments and also in your own care as well as a treatment option. I want to say that this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 941 participants on the call, and I have to say that's a record number for this particular topic. It clearly communicates to all of us that there's a greater interest in the clinical trials and learning about them and even in participating in them. Now, you come from all over the United States. We have participants from all different states in the country and different regions, small cities, large cities, suburban and rural communities. But we also have international participants today from Africa, Canada, China, Ireland, Korea, Philippines, Portugal, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you clearly come from all over the world and a group of truly information seekers. Now, this program today was made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline that the speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as really resources for all of you to use. And there is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask you all to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics that you'd like us to offer going forward? We are in the process of planning many programs for this next 2011 year, and we really want to get your feedback because you are our best advisors in terms of what programs and topics we should offer. Indeed, this topic is one that really has been one that you've all been asking us to offer more frequently. So thank you all, and I now want to introduce our first, we have wonderful faculty today, and I want to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Lawrence Wickham. Dr. Wickham is Associate Chairman, National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, NSABP. Dr. Wickham has been conducting research actually since, I believe we talked earlier, since 1981. He's been really a long-term researcher at the NSABP. And he's going to address an overview of clinical trials and their importance, how they contribute to your treatment options, and how and where they are conducted. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Wickham.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. It is indeed a pleasure to be here today. I thank all the listeners to take some time and learn a little bit more about clinical trials. As you've heard, I spent most of my career involved in the design, conduct, and analysis of these things that we call clinical trials. I work at the National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, or NSABP for short. It's one of our National Cancer Institute's clinical cooperative trials groups. And we conduct trials that are designed to improve the survival and the quality of life of individuals with breast cancer or colorectal cancer. Our headquarters are in Pittsburgh, where I'm located today. But the real work of the organization occurs at our 200 centers and 300-plus satellite centers located throughout the United States, Canada, Puerto Rico, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, and we've just opened a center in Korea. So let's talk a little bit about clinical trials. What is meant by a clinical trial? Well, it's actually a planned experiment that involves patients or participants. That sounds a bit blunt or harsh, and it can make people nervous. They begin to have visions of being a guinea pig. The reality is that trials provide high-quality care that is carefully evaluated and ethically conducted, and arguably is as good or, and sometimes better, than is available outside of clinical trials. Trials are designed to identify the most appropriate treatment or treatments for future patients with a given medical problem. Trials use a relatively small group of patients that can vary from a few dozen to thousands. to provide information on how to treat the general population of patients with that same medical problem who will require treatment in the future. The standard treatments of today were often part of clinical trials in the past. And one of the best examples of that is the NSABP lumpectomy study that began in 1975. There's about 2,000 women who participated in this trial. All of them had breast cancer. And they were assigned to receive either a mastectomy, the standard operation for the treatment of breast cancer at that time, or a lumpectomy, with or without breast radiation. And the results now, more than 25 years after the fact, show that lumpectomy is just as good as mastectomy in long-term outcomes. And today, because of those 2,000 women who entered this trial, we can offer lumpectomies to 100,000 women or more in the United States alone, based on the knowledge, not the hope, but the knowledge that the lumpectomies are just as good as mastectomies. I still see some of these women in long-term follow-up, and I never miss a chance to thank them for their participation. Trials are divided into various types or phases. This can be a long story, and I'm not going to go into great detail. But phase one trials evaluate new treatments with relatively little or no experience in humans. The numbers in a given trial are relatively small. It's rare for them to be more than a few dozen patients. And the patients are usually of various types of cancer. We're talking about cancer trials today, not just a single category of cancer. The goal of a phase one trial, evaluating drugs at least, is to identify the maximum tolerated dose of this new therapy. We often look at the impact of the treatment on the cancer itself, but that's not a primary goal of phase one trials. Following phase one, we start phase two trials that are slightly larger and often involve a single type of cancer. The goal here is to begin to look at effectiveness. Does this therapy work in such patients? And we begin to evaluate safety as well, safety of the newer therapy. Phase three trials are a full-scale evaluation of the treatment. These are much larger studies. They often involve thousands of patients and begin after a drug or a therapy has begun to show reasonably effective in that particular type of cancer. And the next logical step is to compare it to the standard treatment to find out which works better, at least in the simplest form of trials. And at the completion of the trial entry, we want groups of patients that are almost the same for all the patient and tumor characteristics, except for the treatment under evaluation. And in order to assure that balance of characteristics, phase three trials assign patients to treatment group based on random selection. We call it randomization. Neither the patient nor the physician selects the treatment. That's done by chance, usually by a computer. Some of the phase two trials that I mentioned also include such randomization. Some patients are uncomfortable with this chance selection. They want the new therapy, which is understandable. We don't know if this new treatment or therapy is better, or we could not ethically conduct a clinical trial. And there are lots of examples where the new treatment does not result in a better outcome in a phase three trial. That's why we do them. The standard of care group is the treatment that most patients would receive for that difficulty if they didn't enter the trial. And with the oversight and review of the care within trials, it ensures high quality of care regardless of the group that's assigned to that individual patient. When I first became involved in clinical trials in the 1970s, almost all trials were conducted at university hospitals, and most of those were in large cities. That's no longer the case. Two-thirds of NSABP investigators are at non-university community-based sites. And that the result is that patients can have the option of entering state-of-the-art clinical trials without the cost or the burden of travel. They don't have to go to the big university centers to be part of a study. They can get their care close to home with the support of their family and their friends. Let me make one last point. Many patients and some physicians think of trials as something for patients only after standard of care therapies are no longer working. We do have such studies. The phase one trials that I mentioned fall into that category for the most part. But often the largest studies with the greatest future impact are those evaluating treatments at the time of the original cancer diagnosis. And I tell patients all the time to think of trials as a first choice, not a last resort. Let me stop there and turn this back to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wickham, for just a very excellent and outstanding overview of really clinical trials and really how important they are. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. John Leonard. And Dr. Leonard is Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology. He's Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. He's Clinical Director of New York Cornell Center for Lymphoma and Myeloma. And he's Chief Lymphoma Myeloma Service Associate Director for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Cancer Center. And Dr. Leonard, actually, as you can see, wears many hats. And he is going to address what happens in a clinical trial, the meaning of informed consent, and benefits and risks of participation. I now turn the program over to Dr. Leonard.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to Dr. Wickham for the very nice introduction and kind of clinical trial basics regarding this very important topic. And I, too, appreciate the participation of the audience because really this is a crucial topic for patients dealing with cancer or any medical condition for that matter because really when a patient goes into an examination room with a doctor and learns about their prognosis, their treatment options, and what they can and can't do about their disease, it really all stems from clinical trials. So before one can be offered a clinical trial, before a clinical trial is available to a patient and actively recruiting or allowing patients to participate, a lot happens. And in many ways, I think this is a strength of the system and one of the advantages of clinical trials. When I see a patient outside of a trial as a physician, I'm basically treating that patient in the way I know how, and generally speaking, it is a relatively flexible way, which is nice for the patient. But on the other hand, it's less rigorous, it's less controlled, and that one of the advantages of a clinical trial is that the treatment and the evaluation is done in a very organized way that has been reviewed and vetted by many, many people in the field, whether they be patients participating in some of the review of trials or physicians or other experts in the field that have participated there. So when a patient goes on a study, they really have the benefit of undergoing a treatment and evaluation program that has been reviewed and commented upon and edited and discussed by many, many people. And so I personally think that that's a very good thing, and there's some evidence that patients who are treated on clinical trials in the big picture do better. And one might argue that one reason for that possibility is that the treatment really is up to tip-top standards with respect to the review and what goes into the treatment regimen that a patient may be receiving. So studies, when they're developed, every clinical trial has what's called a protocol, and that's basically a large document that is available to the researchers, the physicians, the nurses, the staff involved, that basically outlines the rationale, why this study is being done, why these treatments have been chosen, why these patients are appropriate for this treatment. It outlines all of the details of what's known about the disease and the treatment regimen, if it's a treatment trial, to basically have all that in one place so that everyone involved knows everything they need to know about the treatment. It outlines in a very detailed fashion what tests are going to be done, what doses of a drug, if it's a drug treatment trial, are going to be given, what dose adjustments are to be made, what side effects are expected, and how patients will be monitored. And so the fact that this is all generated in this one place is in a very good tool for the people involved in the care of the patient who's being treated on a clinical trial. Now, this isn't something that's just made up and generated and done in a haphazard way. This is a document, and this document and this protocol that is generated really is then a tool that is reviewed by many, many different people who are assessing the protocol, the study, and making sure it's being done in a proper fashion, in a rigorous fashion, and in an ethical fashion. And so before a study is activated, these protocol documents, the study design, is often vetted by many, many different experts. And you heard about the NSABP. That's one of the National Cancer Institute funded and supported settings for doing clinical trials. And so, for example, there, and Dr. Wickerham could tell us, I'm sure, there are many steps of the process where this protocol is developed. It's reviewed by experts. It is reviewed by committees within the sponsor, the group that's doing the study. It's reviewed by committees perhaps at the FDA or at the National Cancer Institute. And then it's generally also reviewed locally at the individual sites where the study's been done. And so all of the purpose of all of this review is to make sure that the study is being done in a proper fashion. If it's a different type of study, that it may vary a little bit by how many people and where they are located that review this, but at the end of the day, I think a patient going on a study can be confident that what's being planned has been looked at by a variety of different people with different perspectives that have all had their two cents as to how best the study should be done, what information is needed, and any adjustments so that the treatment or monitoring regimen and the right patient population are eligible. So once that's been generated, that those the studies are approved by the various people that need to review them, and again, it depends on the type of study, but I think the final review in most cases is what's called an internal review board. So each institution, whether it's a hospital, a medical center, or even a local private practice, these studies are reviewed, and there's a local group that represents physicians, nurses, patient advocates, and other groups to, again, make sure that this is being done in a careful way. It also results in the generation of what's called a consent form. And so anyone who's been offered a clinical trial has probably looked at a consent form. And this can be a complicated document. Sometimes it goes many pages, but it outlines everything that's known about the drug in layperson's language, everything that a patient can expect reasonably in the study, i.e. what tests are being done, what treatments are being done, issues of what the expected side effects are of the treatment, what the alternative treatments may be, issues of finance, i.e. does my insurance cover it, et cetera. And so all of this is put into one document. And I have to say that this is a very useful tool for a patient. A patient and their family and friends can take a look at this and review it and bring it back to their doctor and ask questions. This process is termed informed consent. And so really what that means is that it is in part a document where in one document, the informed consent document outlines what's expected on a study. But really, it's more than that. Really, the process of informed consent means that a physician or a nurse or other person that's involved in the study really sits down with a patient, explains what's going on, educates them, and this paper, this informed consent document, is a tool to help understand all of that and to have that as a reference. And so this is something that patients will get. It's really several parts to participating, to consenting to participate on a study. It is the healthcare provider explaining to the patient why they think the patient may be appropriate to participate in the study. It's giving the patient this document and perhaps other tools to get more information and understand it. Then it's the patient thinking about this and discussing it with their friends, their family, whoever they feel is necessary, and then coming back to the physician or the healthcare team and saying, okay, now I've looked at this, here are my questions, and so on. And it's a back and forth to make sure that you understand exactly what's involved and that all your questions are answered. And Dr. Mitchell is going to go into this in a little bit more detail as far as questions you should ask. And one of the points I want to make is that the concept of informed consent, well, in practice, can be quite challenging because the healthcare team gives you this document that may be 20 pages long and has a lot of things. And some people say, I trust you, you're my doctor, I want to go ahead and just let's get it going. Some people get intimidated because they think that this is much more complicated, and if they're treated with a standard regimen outside of a study, they don't need to necessarily go through this complicated process. So these are all checks to make sure that the patient is well informed, understands what's planned, has all the questions answered, and then really makes an informed, appropriate decision based on having all the information that they need. And a key focus of the consent process is really the benefits of participating and the risk of participating. And all of the clinical trials that are done have potential benefits and have potential risks. Now, these may be very positive benefits, i.e., it's a promising new treatment drug, and this is a way to get access to it, and therefore the patient is very likely to benefit or has a good chance of benefiting based on what's known about the drug. Or it may be that we really don't know, and the benefits as far as a better outcome may not be that predictable by in advance of participating in the study. And so asking questions about what's known about the drug, what's known about the treatment regimen, why does one think this could be better than the standard treatment that one would get outside of a study? And then on the flip side, what are the risks? What are the potential side effects? What are the things that could go wrong? What are the extra inconveniences and costs and so on as far as a study? And it's a very individualized situation. There are some studies where a patient may be very willing to accept risks because they have limited other options. On the other hand, there may be patients who have a very good prognosis or have many options and where risks are not that tolerable. And so it's a really an individualized decision, and I would encourage people to sit down with their physician, their healthcare team, and ask about the pros and cons and why something like this makes sense. And I think it's important, and I'll close my section here, I think it's very important because in cancer clinical trials, there are certain situations where there can be great excitement, great optimism, great expectations of a study, and others where that's not really to be expected, that the study's being done and one might be hopeful, but it may not be that fair to assume that this is going to result in benefit for the patient. And so it really is a discussion, and it's hard to generalize. I think one really needs to sit down with the healthcare team and ask questions. And that really leads us to the next section. So I'll turn this back over to Carolyn, and I'm sure we'll come back to some of these issues later in the discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lennon, for just a very informative and excellent presentation, as always. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is Clinical Professor of Medicine and Medical Oncology, Department of Medical Oncology, Associate Director of Diversity Programs, Kimmel Cancer Center, Thomas Jefferson University. Now, Dr. Mitchell is going to address questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials, how to become more informed about clinical trials, and accessing information and resources for clinical trials. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, Dr. Leonard and Dr. Wickerham, for your outstanding presentations on clinical trials. I'm going to give you some, and thanks to all the participants today for taking your time to find out about clinical trials. And I tell patients it's information about clinical trials really allows the patient and the patient's family and support system to be well informed. And that should really occur whether it's a clinical trial or whether it is standard therapy for the cancer. It's very important for us to realize that without clinical trials, we would not have the information regarding all of the new therapies that we have available or the old therapies. For example, Dr. Wickerham mentioned the clinical trial regarding lumpectomy. So without clinical trials, we would not know that we can safely and confidently tell patients, and the majority of patients with breast cancer now, that a lumpectomy might be the best therapy available. Also, we wouldn't have tamoxifen or Herceptin or many of the other drugs that are used to treat breast cancer or any other cancers. We would not even have the information on mammograms. So the way that we have learned about all of these new technologies, new medications, new tests, new surgical procedures has been through clinical trials. And for patients, prior to considering a clinical trial, you may want to do your homework. And by that, I mean carry someone else with you to the appointment to discuss a clinical trial. And that other person could be a family member or a friend or someone who is able to give you that support and help. You will want to do your homework prior to that. If you have questions already, write the questions down and carry a pad and pencil or pen with you so that you'll be able to write down answers that the healthcare team will give you. Ask for as much information as possible. And also, ask the healthcare team, what is the standard treatment for this particular disease or disorder or condition? And you'll also want to know, how does the clinical trial differ from what is considered standard therapy for the condition? So that you'll know the difference between what the clinical trial requires and offers and what is considered standard treatment for the condition. And then there are some general questions you'll want to ask the healthcare team and make sure that you have answers that you understand. So what is the purpose of the trial? What do we know about the investigational treatment? Who is paying for the clinical trial? And whether the medical care will cost more or cost less by being on the clinical trial? And whether the cost of tests, of treatments, whether these tests and treatments are covered by insurance. So you will want to know that. And then you'll want to know what are the possible benefits of the clinical trial, both short-term as well as long-term benefits. And by the same token, you'll want to know what are the potential side effects, what are the potential risks, and are there any possible long-term risk? This will be very important. You'll also want to know what kind of tests and procedures are required, how often are these tests and procedures required, where do I go to get the treatment on the trial? Some clinical trials require treatment in a specific hospital or unit, and others allow for treatment in multiple and different facilities. You'll also want to know who is going to be delivering the treatment. Is it your regular doctor? Is it a nurse? Is it a different physician or provider? So you'll want to know that. You'll also want to know, how does this treatment change or affect personal life, daily life? Can you talk to other participants, other clinical trial participants who have gone through the treatment? And what do I do if I have questions? Who do I call? What are the telephone numbers? And by the same token, you'll want to know if I have concerns after hours, on weekends, if there are medical problems that arise, who do I call, where do I call, and what can I expect? You will also want to know, do I take my regular medications just as I have been doing, or will it require some change in my medications? And will my other doctors know about this clinical trial? What kind of information will be given to my other doctors? You'll also want to know, how long am I going to be on this treatment? How often will I have to go to a physician's office? Do I go to the same physician all the time? Or may I obtain some of the tests from my regular physician. So these are all questions that you will want to know. I certainly have not given all of the questions that could be asked, but I hope I've given you an introduction to the fact that clinical trials are really very, very important. They offer patients tremendous benefits, and yes, there are some risks, but all medications have a risk, and therefore, for even standard treatment, you should ask your healthcare team some of the same questions that I have presented today, so that number one, you as a patient or as a patient's support, meaning you could be a family member or a friend, but making sure you understand the expectations from treatment. And that should be done whether it's standard treatment or a clinical trial. A clinical trial does offer patients something that is perhaps new and different from standard therapy. And in many cases, these clinical trials offer additional benefits over and above standard therapy. But you'll want to know all of this prior to embarking on a clinical trial. And you'll want to know if there's information that you may take home to read or take home to discuss with somebody else, perhaps your family doctor or another physician or another medical provider that you have known. So the bottom line is gather as much information as possible so that you can make an informed decision. So with that, I'm going to give the phone back to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mitchell, for just an extraordinarily wonderful presentation and really for really identifying many of the questions and things that you really want to ask your physician, your healthcare team, so you feel most informed. Now, I want to thank all of our speakers because now we have lots of time for questions, and I want to thank them for that very much. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers back on board for the questions, and she'll explain to you, Trinitha will tell you how to queue up for questions. And if we do not get to your question, please know that you can contact Cancer Care at the end of the program at 1-800-813-HOPE. I'll repeat that again toward the end of the call as well. But we'd like to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And so you do have the best of the best here to ask questions of, and please let's let the questions begin. So, Trinitha, would you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll do our best.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Meryl S. Your question, please.
My question is really a statement. When my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in a small community, very little information about clinical trials. It took a lot of looking for the information, which would be discouraging to some people. I feel that your provider should be telling you, any cancer patient, about trials, and they aren't prepared to do that all the time. So you
That's
have
an excellent point. Did you want to ask a question in addition to the statement?
I think that the clinical trial that are available that you can look for are excellent, but you have to be directed that way. That's basically all I wanted to say, is there isn't enough information prior to getting to the clinical trials and where they are. You need to be urged to look at those. My husband is doing beautifully just because we found.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Meryl. That's really you really have put a bit of a call to action out for everybody. I'm going to ask Dr. Mitchell to address the question in terms of just really how do you, because it's the concept of really being so proactive, and you obviously were, and really, but really had to work very hard, that it wasn't easy for you to find the information you needed. Dr. Mitchell, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I will. Patients can obtain information on clinical trials from their healthcare team, but there are also really good sources of information that are from other resources. For example, the NSABP that Dr. Wickerham mentioned, there is a website where individuals with breast cancer or colon and rectal cancer may obtain information. There are also patient advocacy organizations. For example, for breast cancer, there is the Komen Foundation, which is one. For pancreatic cancer, since participant asked the question about pancreatic cancer, there is an organization called PanCan. And PanCan specifically provides information to patients regarding a number of issues. Your organization, Dr. Messner, Cancer Care, provides a lot of information. So for the specific cancers, one can go to a lot of patient advocacy organizations to get information. Another area for general information is NIH, that's the National Institutes of Health, .gov, and there are clinicaltrials.gov, and there is information there. I do warn individuals, however, there's a lot of information on the web that is not representative of what we would want patients to know, and therefore some of these sites should be avoided. But go to the good sites, the clinicaltrials.gov, the specific advocacy organizations for the specific cancers, and start there if you want information outside of what your healthcare team provides. Just be careful about sites on the web that are not valid, that give out erroneous or bad information.
And that's really so important, what Dr. Mitchell has said, that you really want, when you're trying to seek information, of course, you can start with your healthcare team. But you had said, Meryl, that was problematic, but sometimes it isn't. Some teams can help to direct you. You can actually contact on the materials you receive from Cancer Care. All those different advocacy groups have information about clinical trials. And I would say that the National Cancer Institute, the 1-800 for cancer, or their website, www.cancer.gov, is a wonderful resource. That's in your materials. And there also is, of course, the American Cancer Society. It has a tremendous amount of information. And also, if you're just really struggling, to really go ahead and call Cancer Care, because we do have 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to answer your questions. So basically, if you have a question, you're having trouble getting information, please do go ahead and just call us, because that's really, we can help to direct you. But I think, as Dr. Mitchell has said, there's just so many organizations out there that are credible, and then there are others that really aren't as well known. So better to call a place that you know has that stamp of approval and start with them and see who they can refer you to. And I think PanCan is a wonderful resource for people with pancreatic cancer, and there are many groups like that for specific types of cancer. Dr. Leonard, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I would just reiterate, I think, what the point that the caller really wanted to make, and that is that it can be hit or miss as to how much your healthcare team, how much information they can directly provide you. I mean, most healthcare providers in oncology are familiar with clinical trials, but what specific details they can give you may be quite variable. And so my advice would be, if you certainly ask your healthcare team, your physician, your nurse, your social worker, what clinical trials are available, where you're being treated. But you can also ask, and if they say, well, we don't know, or we're not aware, I think that one of the things one could do would be to say, well, okay, what centers locally that are not far from where I live or where I'm being treated, where do you refer patients who are interested in clinical trials? And I would say that even if a local center is not doing clinical trials there at the site where you're treated, they can generally give you a name of a physician or a name of a center where clinical trials are going on that is not that are not too far that you could at least seek more information. And I think the resources that were mentioned can be quite helpful as well. But in oncology and in cancer treatment, you generally should be able to get a referral to some place that can tell you more. But often the patient and their family have to be very, very proactive, and I would encourage people to ask the question and to at least seek out information. And obviously being on this call is a good first step in that regard. But if you don't ask, it may not be an option. And it doesn't mean you have to participate in a clinical trial just because you ask, but I think you owe it to yourself to be well-informed.
Excellent. Dr. Wickerham, do you want to add anything as well?
Yeah, just briefly, I agree with all that's been said, but one last for your callers. They shouldn't be concerned if they're asking their doctors about a referral or information about clinical trials that their physicians are going to be angry at them. This is a standard sort of practice and nothing that would upset your caregivers. It's unexpected these days.
So, actually, Meryl, thank you for asking that wonderful first question, and I have a feeling it's going to come up again in other questions, so thank you very much for starting this off. Thank you. And our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Rosalind R. Your question, please.
Hi. I know that not everything in a clinical trial is free, so I'm wondering about insurance payment of such things and whether clinical trials include follow-up care and how long it would be for after the trial's over.
Okay, well, thank you. Those are wonderful questions. I'm going to ask Dr. Mitchell to address it initially, and then we'll probably all add something. Dr. Mitchell, do you want to take that one first?
Yes, and thank you so much for the call, Rosalind, and this question. Some clinical trials are covered almost totally by insurance, meaning that any test required, any x-rays or scans would also be covered in addition to the treatment and the physician's visit. Some clinical trials, however, do not require our insurances do not cover all of the cost, and these are things you'll want to ask your healthcare team. So just like some medical standard treatments or tests might not be covered by insurance, for clinical trials, the same could be true. So it's very important to ask about that. Now, for those costs that are not covered by insurance, many clinical trials do have methods of obtaining payment for those costs. For example, the American Cancer Society has methods for coverage of additional cost and test. Cancer Care, which is Dr. Messner's organization, has methods of assisting patients with unexpected or uncovered costs, as do a lot of other organizations, including some local hospitals that also have methods of coverage of costs that might not be covered by insurance. So again, this is an area that might vary from one trial to another. It might vary from one local area to another in reference to covered cost by insurance. So these are questions you will want to ask the healthcare team about the clinical trial, but also these are questions you will want to ask regarding standard therapy. So it's always better to ask the questions about what insurances cover and costs that potentially could occur but are not covered by insurance.
Excellent. Thank you. And I just actually do want to add that we, in the treatment of cancer, of course, our goal is to not have the cost be a barrier to your treatment. And so many organizations, Cancer Care being one of them, has a financial assistance program and a copay assistance program in which we really try to help figure out ways to either directly help to pay for some of those, offset those costs, or help to direct you. There are many organizations, and there are many different ways to get those the things that you need funded. So I would recommend that you have someone working with you on that. It's a hard thing to do all by yourself. Sometimes your institutions can help you with it, of course, but sometimes they may not be able to know all the resources because there's just a huge number of them throughout the country. So I wouldn't want anyone to feel that if someone says, gee, we don't cover that or it's not covered. There also is an appeal process with insurance companies. There's an appeal process with entitlement programs. So working with social work staff who can help you with that is very important. That's really very important. Dr. Leonard or Dr. Wickerman, do you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I'll jump in. Rosalind also asked about follow-up in these trials. That can vary from trial to trial and from phase to phase, but it's an important part of many of the large phase 3 trials. We want to make certain that the therapies under evaluation continue to work over the long term, but also that there aren't any long-term side effects that may not have been recognized up until that time. Now, patients have the option of dropping out of these studies. That's part of the consent form. It talks all about that. So you shouldn't be intimidated that you have to be part of a trial for 5 or 10 years, although you have a problem, a disease that often is chronic, and maintaining that follow-up and making certain that somebody's calling you to remind you about the obligations of follow-up for your benefit is an important part of such studies as well.
I would just add that, as was mentioned, I mean, people should, it's really study and trial specific, and I think it's most important. You don't want to not participate because you're worried about the cost. I think it's key to find out what the information is, and sometimes in certain studies, one can get an expensive drug for free as part of being for the study. So sometimes it can actually turn out to one's financial benefit. And again, I don't want people to assume that that's the case, but just make sure that you understand what the situation is, because it really does depend on the specifics of the individual trial that one is participating in.
Excellent. And it's so very important, you know, to actually to really work with that team and be sure that you get all your questions answered, and if you have other questions, to really turn to other sources to get the questions answered that you need. So very important. And our next question?
Thank you. Our next question is from Lori I. Your question, please.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. And hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Do you think that, and this is for all of the everyone on the panel, but do you think that we in the cancer community have been effective in moving the needle on increasing enrollment in cancer clinical trials over the last 10 years? And then that's really just more of a yes or no question. And then just as a follow-up, how do you think we can be most effective to help patients and anyone affected by cancer learn about trials and help them understand that they're a valuable option for their care?
Okay. Well, Dr. Wickerman, do you want to go first with that one?
Sure. Unfortunately, the number of patients entering trials on a percentage basis is remarkably low. And that's probably for a variety of reasons. There's not a single thing we can point to and would be able to correct. But I think one of the ways to improve the understanding of clinical trials in general is programs like we're having today and education to the general public. Most of the time when you hear this information, you're not a patient. You're healthy. And if the message doesn't come to you then, you may forget about it by the time you or a family member or a friend becomes a potential candidate for a clinical trial. The NCI for years has been trying to educate the public about such things, but their budget for this type of public education is about as much as they spend, as the beer companies spend on a commercial during the Super Bowl. So from a public education standpoint, it could be far more effective if we could do it on a more continuing basis. Healthcare providers are the next source of clinical trials, and we've talked about that already. There, too, the message needs to be a constant one.
And Dr. Leonard, did you want to?
Well, I would just add that, you know, in certain parts of the world, the vast majority of patients go on clinical trials for certain situations. I happen to work in lymphoma, and in Germany, over 80% of patients with certain types of lymphoma go on clinical trials. I think that in my mind, that's not even necessary. I mean, that would be lovely. But even just having a slight increase in the percentage of people going on clinical trials would make a difference. And for certain studies that require only a few hundred patients, having perhaps 100 patients across the country extra going on a study in a given year might mean that that study gets completed in 2 years rather than 3 years, for instance. And if that's the case and that study has an impact and actually improves outcomes, that could more quickly affect many, many lives. And so I think really the rate of progress, and everyone wants cancer treatments to get better, the rate of progress is the biggest stumbling block is the number of patients that go on clinical trials, the rates that people participate. And so while that may not be enough for patients for themselves to go on a study, I think it is an important part of the equation that if a study may be right for you, you can not only potentially help yourself, but help others. And in certain studies, the first people that will benefit from a new and improved treatment are the ones that participated on the study. And so I think, again, I don't want to overpromise what studies can deliver, but I think it is important for people to keep in mind as an option. And I think there are many factors that contribute to this slow accrual, but even a small increase can make a big difference.
Dr. Mitchell?
Yes, both of the speakers have given great answers to that question. I would just like to add that one thing that we can do, I think, in this country is obtain more information. Education and information is very important. But you have to remember, we are a nation of fast things. We like fast food. We like quick medical care, and sometimes clinical trials are seen as, or the time to institute a trial or to institute treatment is seen as a barrier. But if we realize that this really is not a barrier, but it's an opportunity to get more information about the disease process or condition, to be informed in decision-making, we'll find that the clinical trials, while they might require a little bit more information, a little bit more time, in the long run, that can save us a lot of time, a lot of effort, and might offer an option for treatment that might be superior or more beneficial than standard treatment. So I think we have to get away from the fast food kind of mentality where we want everything to happen real quickly and take the time to obtain the information.
And that's such an important point, Dr. Mitchell, that indeed that it is really an investment in yourself, and indeed it is also in terms of your care, and it is truly a treatment option. And so and we hope we offer these programs in the hope that people will take away this information and really go back to the treating healthcare team and become more informed about clinical trials. Clearly, the interest is greater now than ever before, but we still have our work cut out for us. So back to that call to action from Merrill. And now our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Donna B. Your question, please.
Yes. Is there a standard time of follow-up on clinical trials in general, or would a patient, after a period of time, maybe go back into standard care?
That's an excellent question. Dr. Leonard, would you like to address that?
Well, it very much depends on the clinical trial and its specifics. So generally speaking, if one is talking about a treatment clinical trial, the patient would receive a treatment, a course of treatment, which, depending on the study, may last several months, may last years. It depends on the specific situation, and then would generally be followed and monitored, as one would often do in standard care. Whether or not one would then go on to get other treatment, typically in most trials, depending on the situation, if it's a regimen that is going to give the patient a long-term remission or even a cure, at some point, usually years, but again, it very much depends, the treatment interval, or the monitoring interval, I should say, goes down, and patients may just be monitored once a year or something of that nature to see how they're doing in the long term. Whereas in a situation where a patient gets a course of treatment, and if the disease is one, if the disease setting is one where the disease comes back within months or maybe a year or two, then typically a study would generally end when the disease progresses and when then the patient is appropriate for a second treatment or a new treatment, in which case that whole decision would be made as a kind of a separate process. So it really depends on the individual situation, and I think it's a very important question to ask, because you would like to know what do you expect the monitoring period to be, which is going to be a reflection of what one would expect out of the disease and the effectiveness of the treatment, to know what's going to be an adequate time period to really monitor the effect that is being examined as part of the study. You also, you know, if you're a patient receiving a treatment, the benefit of being followed for a long time means that you're being monitored closely for a long time, which may in some ways be inconvenient, but may also be good because you have people keeping track of how you're doing in case something pops up down the line as a function of your disease or the treatment.
Excellent. And Dr. Wickerham, did you want to add anything?
I agree with it all. I don't really have anything to add to that answer.
Okay. And Dr. Mitchell?
Oh, I agree. I think that every follow-up plan depends on the specific clinical trial, the disease process, and the various tests that are done in relationship to the clinical trial. So every clinical trial will be different. Every follow-up period will also be different, but these are questions that should be specifically geared toward the individual clinical trial.
Thank you. Okay, our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Robert L. Your question, please.
Hi, this is Mrs. L. We went through the process of trying to find a clinical trial. As physicians, are you making changes to make it more simple for the people who are just getting educated on cancer and the type of cancer that they have to be able to research those clinical trials themselves, or staffing your social workers at these different foundations that help so that these people are educated in finding them? Because that was the hardest part of trying to find a clinical trial, was we couldn't understand the language that those clinical trials were written in.
Oh, you make an excellent point. Thank you. There is a great effort to make the both the consent forms and the information about clinical trials much more public-friendly, much more readable for everyone. And so there is a lot of effort being put in this direction, but obviously there's much more that has to be done. I'm going to ask Dr. Wickerham, actually, if he would speak to that as well.
Well, I think some of the resources we've talked about earlier are important for you, and getting somebody who can translate this difficult language to the individual patient is an important step. Carolyn's organization, where you're talking to master's level social workers, is probably the one I refer to the most. The 1-800 for cancer number at the National Cancer Institute also is a similar line where you can talk to real human beings who are used to explaining these things to patients. The websites vary. Some are more user-friendly than others. They are kept up to date, but the individual people that you talk to are always a far more valuable source in my experience.
Well, that's a very good point. Having actually a person to talk to can be very helpful, especially when the language is difficult. You can't understand what's written in front of you. Dr. Mitchell, do you want to add anything?
Certainly. I think having another family member or another friend or support person to help you. Many times with a diagnosis of cancer, there can be some anxiety over the diagnosis, worry about what is going to happen in the future, and having another person will be helpful. It does not have to be someone in the medical community, and this is true whether the patient has a medical background or not. And I can tell you, one of my best friends is a nurse but developed breast cancer and called me up and said, I've been a nurse all of these years. And when I was asked, did I have a question, I couldn't remember what questions to ask. So it's really important to have a friend, a family member, another support person to help you with the data and information collection, and then to help guide you through the decision-making process. So get somebody else to go with you.
And if I can jump back in, many of the major cancer centers now have navigators that fulfill this role locally as well and can be an important resource from finding everything to clinical trials to where to park.
Excellent point. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been exceptional. And I want to thank all of you who've actually queued up and asked such terrific questions. All of your questions really have added to the program today. And we could go on, of course, all afternoon, but this is a one-hour workshop. And I do want to remind you that although this program is 1 hour in length, the services that you can access, those continue endlessly from all the organizations that are listed. And I'm going to say a word about cancer care before we conclude, just to remind all of you that it's a free resource, first of all. It's staffed by 60 NASA's level trained oncology social workers. And we are here to provide all sorts of information, from very practical and financial information, financial help, actually, to counseling services, someone to talk to. We also offer support groups online and on the telephone. We have lots of fact sheets and informational materials that could be very useful to you, booklets. And, of course, we have lots of these workshops. Most importantly, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone. Some of you expressed during the call that you did feel kind of alone trying to figure things out. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support. We're simply a telephone call away, 1-800-813-HOPE. And I hope you'll take advantage of these services and so that we can help you as you find your way with this. This is a very important area, but there are many other issues you may be dealing with as well. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. That concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.